Hey, hello. So welcome to episode 3 of the Shropshire Witches podcast. We are very, very excited. And this week is full witchy, spooky week. So we're very excited to come at you with our Halloween special. I'm Alex, and I'm going to pass straight over to Amy because Amy's going to tell you a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. Amy, hello.
Hello. So we're going to be basically today doing a bit of a deep dive into some of the traditional aspects of Halloween. Mm-hmm. We're not so much looking at kind of like 1980s Halloween masks or things like that, but what Halloween meant, or the period of Halloween meant to people in Shropshire, as well as further afield. So we're going to look at things like depictions of ghosts in literature, and also things like All Saints and All Souls Day, and it's going to be a wonderful spooky time.
I'm very excited about this. And it's a perfect week, isn't it? I mean, for anyone listening to this outside of Halloween as well, it doesn't matter because this is always going to be relevant. But I think this is the perfect week to kind of have a good excuse to be even spookier than normal, maybe.
Every day's Halloween. Every day can be
it
Halloween.
It really is, isn't it? We love spooky stuff. It's fine. So go on. We might as well, in terms of Halloween, should we go out with the history of this? I mean, when it's traced back, and the influence of it in Shropshire. So do you want to start? Do you want me to start? Like, what do you want to do in terms of?
Yeah, so I can give you a little bit of an overview, and then we can go from there. So yeah. Halloween is a relatively new concept in the way that we see it today. So the things like kind of the pumpkins and the spooky stories and stuff like that have origins in a lot later, but it's very different if we look at more traditional forms of it in the county. So yeah. Traditionally, these traditions around what we would call Hallowmas or Hallowtide, they kind of are quite fluid in themselves. So they go from about the 30th of October all the way through, in some cases, to certainly the 1st and the 2nd of November, but sometimes as far as like the 4th or the 5th of November. And this is what we would call the Hallowmas. And that was traditionally, it incorporated a number of different festivals, including All Saints and All Souls Day.
Yeah.
And All Saints Day was the time in which you would kind of remember all of the saints, and it's often said that it would be those saints that are remembered and also those unknown saints, which I think is quite cool, the idea of there being saints that people didn't even know of. But it has its origins very much in a religious significance, particularly from kind of medieval going through, and I think even when you get to the kind of Reformation and things like that, it doesn't necessarily lose its religious significance. It just shifts from being about the saints and kind of a more Catholic understanding to a more still religious, but more of a kind of Protestant idea of religion. But certainly it has its origins. It's nothing. I remember being told various ways when I was younger that it was the devil's birthday, or it was somehow linked to the devil, but it actually has its origins in a very, very religious significance. I suppose the devil's religious too, but in a very Christian significance.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I suppose just kind of touching on what you're saying there, because, you know, I love any excuse to kind of mention the Reformation, but it's interesting because this sort of... this deep history that it has. And I suppose, like you say, it's interesting how it survived through, when the idea of even just the sort of the roles of saints changed, because that is relevant in terms of when we go into talking about ghosts, we can talk more about that. But this idea of how this was celebrated and the role of saints completely changed when obviously we ceased to be sort of, I suppose, it was still Catholic in all but name, wasn't it, really, in terms of before it became a hardline kind of Protestant religion. But equally, that idea that the way we were viewing the saints and things changed with Halloween just changed across the board, didn't it? Because the role in terms of saints' days and ghosts and things like that, and the role of ghosts became completely different post-Reformation as well, which we can talk more about afterwards. But I think the other thing as well that's interesting, now, do I say this right? Is it Samhain? You know, the old, I think that's the Irish name for it, isn't it? And then the Welsh, I cannot say.
No, I can't either.
But you've got things like you say like Winter's Night, all these kind of festivals. And I always thought it was interesting because I was aware of a feast day that moved from the start of November. I thought it was around about, so as you're saying, how far into November it can go. But this idea of Halloween, do you think in terms of, because I know you're obviously, you are very kind of, you're one that's interested in the land and folklore and how these things usually explain away natural phenomena. I think, you know, is it a way of explaining that actually as the summer and all these seasons come to an end, you've got a long winter ahead of you, that we're looking at something that's going to kind of make peace with what's ahead. So I know it's spooky, maybe arguably came spookier as modernity stepped in, but is it one of those things that you do you think was a way of kind of seeing us into the winter, into all the kind of the slightly sort of depressive months that were coming ahead?
Yeah, definitely. And I think there is a natural conclusion to some of the events traditionally in kind of more agrarian societies. You've had the harvest, you've had times where, and it's a bit more of a winding down kind of thing. And I think certainly, I think the mind turns to try and find a way to deal with the darkness and all of the things that come with the darkness, like the, even things like the noise of the wind, and that could all be something in which inspires some of these spooky stories. I think human beings have a natural kind of penchant for the kind of ghosts and the spooky anyway, but I think certainly when it gets to winter and the winter months, we're most kind of inclined for it. One thing I think is really interesting about kind of modern ideas of Halloween that kind of linked to the idea of All Saints and All Souls Day is the idea of them being days in which commemorate the faithfully departed. So at least to a certain extent, there is the idea that they are a day where you remember your ancestors and those who have departed, either close relatives or ones that go further back.
Yeah.
And this, in Shropshire at least, it tended to involve personal prayer, intercessions and prayers for intercessions for souls in purgatory, but also visits to cemeteries.
Okay.
And what I think is really interesting is even to this day, quite popular media about Halloween is that it's the day when the veil is the thinnest.
Oh yeah, that's the bit I always, you know, you hear that crop up sometimes, and that does kind of give proper creepy, doesn't it, when they say the veil is the thinnest at the moment.
Yeah. And so you've got this idea that even today we see it as in a way linked in some way to those who have gone, those who aren't a physical presence anymore, but are a spiritual presence, and that can still in a way influence or enact, you know, within our own lives. And I particularly like the idea of the visiting of the cemeteries. It's not something we tend to associate with Halloween anymore, but it's something that was very much an aspect of the way in which this was celebrated, and the certain times of year in Shropshire that you tended to go to a cemetery more than others, and Hallow Mass is one of them. Another one, quite bizarrely, was Mothering Sunday. A little bit off topic, but on Mothering Sunday and on Palm Sunday, you were meant to visit cemeteries, and on Palm Sunday in particular, you're meant to decorate all the graves with wildflowers that are grown locally. So there's certainly times of year where you visit cemeteries, but there is this idea that Halloween has always been linked to the dead and to a commemoration of the dead, which I think then leads on to ghost stories and the way in which ghosts have been depicted, particularly when you get into kind of the Victorian idea of the ghost.
Yeah, the Victorians were kind of the, I mean, I think, you know, we are kind of the masters of creating a ghost story, aren't they? They absolutely love it. And I think what's interesting as well is kind of with Halloween maybe being something that you would, or a lot of people now kind of dismiss as an American holiday, is the Irish that took it over there, wasn't it? That's the other thing. But I think it's just so fascinating, because this idea to me that we kind of have to make peace with everything that's coming in the winter, you know, the kind of the how claustrophobic it is as well, and you know, illnesses, everything that I mean, maybe less so nowadays, but certainly historically that was associated with that dark time. But how people then as much as now, need something that sort of breaks things up. And for a kind of a modern, I was going to say audience, but you know what I mean? But modern society, people think, well, Christmas, but then, you know, you get all the people that are like, oh, spooky bitches, got a bit of Halloween and pumpkin spice, all these things. And whatever it may be, whether you're kind of going, you know, I'm seeing this wave at the moment, particularly on things like Twitter or X or whatever they call it these days, but, you know, I can't keep up with the young. Mind you, Elon isn't young, is he? I mean, he's awful as well, but never mind. But yeah, they're talking about these... or maybe it's the algorithm because it's the people that you and I follow on Twitter, but talking about carving turnips and these things that are historic. And what I love is even people that sort of are kind of a little bit dismissive of history or anything like that and find it, you know, they're like, oh, it's not really relevant to me. They're doing things within this time of year that are ancient. And yeah. I find that is, to me, that's fascinating. And I think... man's kind of desire to be exciting and new, but actually all the while kind of being atavistic is never kind of surprising to me. We always think that we're kind of movers and shakers and things, but a lot of what we're doing are really deeply historic things. And I think Halloween is a kind of prime example of that. I mean, maybe our call for horror films and things has changed, but has it? Because like you're saying about ghost stories, it's just a narrative in a slightly different way. It's more visual, but you know, people were sitting around, you know, the fire, wherever it may be, wanting to hear a story about something that was really, frankly, bloody terrifying. And I think that the thing that differs is just in which generation finds what terrifying. It's like the altars, doesn't it, in terms of what is scary to us. But this kind of hunger for Halloween and anything that's gothic is nothing new by any stretch, is it?
Oh, no, definitely. I think we tread very well-trodden ground. Mm-hmm. And I think even when we don't realise we're doing something our ancestors did or the people that came before us did, even down to things like kind of storytelling and the consumption of the sort of media we consume, there will always be a desire for the ghost, I think, because I think the ghost is so innately human. And I think that... it is our way of conceptualizing our time. And I think
that's just interesting.
Just as kind of the advent of industry was very confusing and there was lots going on, and it must have been such a shock to the system. For, you know, particularly where we both live in Shropshire, it's very agrarian. It must have been such a shock to the system to live through that advent of industry, that first generation. Yeah. I think equally you could argue that the kind of resurgence of the ghost is linked to our advent of technology. You know, if you think we're both in our 30s, how much actual technology we have experienced. How much life has changed since we were children.
Oh, insane. And I'm older than you, sadly, but yeah.
You don't look it though.
So you're too kind.
I think in a way.
God, you made an old lady very happy. Yeah.
I think in a way the ghost is our, or could also be quite an emotional support.
Yeah, it's our constant companion in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, we seek an understanding, we seek an answer in a world that is confusing, so we resort back to these age-old archetypes. And you could even say, you know, there's a resurgence in things like witchcraft and things like that. These are things that have always been there. We're just using them in different ways now, I think.
I think that's fascinating. And you know what I think is so interesting is, and I know that, you know, you and I, and certainly definitely me, I mean, you're a little bit less judgy than me with things like this, so I imagine you're going to be more tolerant. But, you know, it's the same when I kind of see like pictures of witchcraft and things, you know, like if you or I are putting a post up or something and we choose different pictures, but, and I love all those. And then every so often you see one that's kind of very AI and very pumpkin spicy kind of witch. And I like, you know, that doesn't represent witches. But look, you know, the thing is, in the Victorian times, like the images that I kind of love, you know, they would have been the kind of pumpkin spice of their day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like
and it's the same medieval time. I think there's always going to be like basic witches and spooky witches and things like that. And I think that's quite cool. And I think, again, like the Victorians, you know, they absolutely loved making, so like getting something that was very gothic and old and completely reinventing it for themselves to fit their narrative. And I think what's so fascinating as well is that when you look at things like, you know, the 1st of November as the feast day for All Saints and All Hallows, and then is it the 2nd is All Souls, or I mean, you're better with these dates than me, certainly. But, you know, once, like you were saying, the Reformation things came in, this idea of, you know, the early Christian martyrs and things like that, like they were kind of had to be seen as old hat, but actually people didn't really kind of turn their backs on them. And this idea of ghosts, you know, if purgatory in a Protestant, you know, Reformation didn't, purgatory no longer existed, well, you know, you're not going to want to leave heaven. And if you're in hell, the devil ain't letting you out. So how do you explain away ghosts, particularly at this time of year when the veil is at its thinnest? You know, then comes this idea that ghosts are the ultimate, you know, deception. They're kind of, you know, they're mimicking or looking like someone that we knew as a deception. You know, this whole idea of what ghosts were changes. And I just think it's so fascinating. And I think, you know, even now, if you ask people about ghosts, and particularly at this time of year, people always have a very different idea, don't they? Some talk about stone tape theory and things like this, and others completely believe that, you know, the ghost of a whomever can take your hand and guide you through the cellar. You know, whatever it may be, it seems that our idea of what a ghost is as rigid and yet no more tangible than it was in medieval England. We didn't know then, but it seems so clear to us. So for something that we're so ambiguous about, it also seems so clear in our minds what it is. So it's such a strange contrast, isn't it? But it does seem to be the leveler and the continuation throughout history, is this fixation with ghosts. It's just never, I don't think it's ever going to go away, because we don't know, do we? That's the thing. I never answered, but it's just fascinating how it keeps rearing its head.
Yeah,
and I think it's perspective of religion often as well.
I think it's inherently personal as well. Mm-hmm. So, like, even though, as we've probably shown through the podcast episodes, we are very similar. We've got very similar interests.
Yeah.
But I bet if we was to both have a paranormal experience right now.
Yeah.
I hope we don't.
Oh, don't you just give me the creeps now. I'm sitting and I'm going, oh, bloody hell.
But I think if
look
we
at
were
the biggest wimps ever, we're talking about ghosts at the age, and then we're like, don't come and see us, we're too scared.
Please don't. But I think if we was to both have
please
it,
do, but we don't.
It would mean a very different thing to each of us, and we would experience it in a different way. And I think that's what's so exciting as well, is how it's so, oh, I just love it. It's just so personal and human. And I think even if you are a skeptic and you don't believe in ghosts, the power of these stories, you know, is just, it's so linked to history. I see them so much as a tool for the historian to try and pick away a group of people that otherwise aren't represented. And sometimes, you know, they are represented in things like literature, like Dickens portrays the working classes, you know, very well to a certain extent. But the ghost stories give us an access into what people were actually thinking and believing. And I think that's what's really exciting.
I think that's really interesting. And I think there's always this contrast again of, like, say Dickens is the master, and I know we'll go into kind of talking about that a little bit later on about ghosts and literature and things, but Dickens is this master of portraying the working class. But also the contrast to that is the way he writes is so verbose and so kind of loquacious that actually he's using language that was not relatable to people at that time. So even when it's being sold in pamphlets, and what did people said that Oliver Twist was a Newgate magazine, didn't they? Which I can imagine wasn't thrilled about. But, you know, this sort of beautiful, stylistic writing that is so iconic to him, describing all these things that are bringing the plights of the rookeries and things like this and the working class to the forefront, but written in a way that absolutely could not be enjoyed by anyone but probably the middle class and above. You know what I mean? Because, like, he's using words that you're like, what? You know, it's not. And I think it's such an interesting contrast. And I think, you know, I suppose the other thing is, as well, about things like ghosts and Halloween and stuff like that, is because, you know, this book that I showed you last night about folklore, which is fantastic, they make this really interesting point that actually there's a French chap, his name I can't remember, which is really irritating. I should have written it down. And if I were you, I would have done, because you are much better at this than me. But he was talking about going to rural communities, I mean, talking in sort of 1920s. And a lot of them still held these beliefs, folkloric beliefs and things, but they sort of laughed a bit about it while they were telling him, you know, horseshoes and things like this. But equally, it seemed that they had travelled through and society, or sections of society that weren't literate or anything like that. But these stories remained pretty much unaltered, because they'd been, you know, you learnt them by rote basically, and that was it. They became part of your life. And obviously as things changed and, you know, trains and things like that, you know, everything opened up a little bit. But, you know, even the younger generations for a time all told these same stories, all celebrated these things in the same way. Like, is it Mary Lloyd, you know, that the horse when they go to people's houses, and apparently there's a renaissance of her as a younger community of Welsh people now doing that. And I just think it's, yeah, it's fascinating that maybe the more modern we get, the more we hark back to the past. If people like John Ruskin and William Morris, you know, they kind of had that sort of Bloomsbury set ideal, didn't they, of sort of going, yeah, we should go back to the old ways, now everything's industry. But we do that as well. And I think Halloween, you know, people are starting to think maybe we shouldn't have everything made of plastic. Maybe we should do turnips and not pumpkins anymore. And let's go back to the old ways. And you think that in itself is following a trend.
Yeah.
Everything, nothing is original. And, you know, we're all guilty of that. We've got no choice because everything's been around for so long. How can you be original? But it's funny that even when you think you're harking back to the old ways, you're like, look, you know, William Morris was doing that in the 1800s. Like, that's nothing new. You know, everyone's always wanted to hark back to an era they think was better, which probably never was. It was just slightly different.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think it's very natural. And I think it's such a natural thing to do, to try. And I think that's when we move on to looking a little bit about souling. One thing that I think is really interesting about souling is that there's a tendency in the past to maybe see it with through quite rose-tinted spectacles, the idea of this lovely rural tradition. But in reality, when we actually turn to it, it's a sign of rural poverty, and it's a sign of, you know, how much people had to beg and borrow and kind of eke out a living in really quite difficult environment, but also during the coldest, darkest months. And it's quite interesting as well that in Shropshire, at least, there are a number of festivals that are loosely linked to religion. So you've got one around Christmas, I think it's 21st of December. You've got also Halloween, kind of Hallowmas, where there was a ritual where people would go begging. And they'd go from house to house to beg for oats if it's the one at Christmas, or soul cakes if it's the one, you know, at Halloween. And it's lovely, and there's a little song sung and that kind of thing. But it was in reality a sign that people were struggling. They would go to the richer farmers' houses to try and beg something from them to help them. And even things in Shropshire like the Border Morris, Morris dancing, the Border Morris originated in Shropshire, at least, as a way for the men to kind of earn a little bit of money or get paid in beer or what have you, in order to try and eke out that existence. And I think when we do look at the past sometimes, particularly rural life, there's an aspect of this idea that it's lovely, it's this beautiful rural Arcadia, and everyone was lovely and jolly and happy. And in reality, it was an incredibly difficult existence. And I think souling kind of demonstrates that.
Yeah. This romanticism of the bucolic life, which is a kind of, again, like, you know, your Marie Antoinette kind of making that dress in the little sort of, I can't remember the name of that kind of house that she went to live like a French peasant. And you're like, oh, yeah, the irony.
Yeah.
But to be honest, like I say, I think in probably... how many times I mentioned the Bloomsbury set, but it's the same idea of these people that come from enormous privilege painting this idea of wanting to be bohemians because they can afford to be. And it's, yeah, it's interesting that people romanticize this idea, and even things like Morris dancing that now has got a very kind of sort of like a fairly kind of middle-class village image, hasn't it, really? But to how these things were actually brought about, and even the, you know, the chimney sweep who's considered good luck, and you're like, God, I mean, that, if you want to talk about a job that kind of involved a lot of cruelty and things like that, then that would be the one. But I think it's, you know, it's this romanticism of things is kind of not new, is it? I mean, going through even kind of into the 20th century and looking at how like the Americans are celebrating Halloween and things like that, and then the kind of the evangelical with their sort of fire and brimstone standing on the high street preaching, you know, kind of condemning festivals and things like this. And, you know, it's just so interesting, this kind of contrast, and how people view other parts of society either in such an idyllic way or absolutely condemn them. It's extraordinary. it's really interesting. I did say as well, but I didn't think, do you know the words to that song? I mean, I'm not going to make you sing it, but do you know the words to it?
The Souling Song.
Yeah.
So there's several different versions.
Okay.
So just for people that aren't aware, Souling, the basic premise of Souling was that people would go around between kind of the 1st of November and the 2nd of November for most of Shropshire. Mm-hmm. This ritual isn't unique to Shropshire. Shropshire's a stronghold of it, and Staffordshire was as well, but it did happen all over Britain and probably further afield. But they'd go from house to house, usually in the more well-heeled neighbourhood, and knock on the door, and they'd sing a little ditty, and they'd get a reward. And that reward, depending on, I suppose, the farmer or the farmer's wife, would be soul cakes, ale, apples, or money. Mm. And soul cakes are kind of, they're a little bit more like a biscuit, really. Okay. But they're kind of like a kind of biscuity type cake, very simple, usually made from stuff that's in the home.
Okay.
That it wasn't meant to be something that was ostentatious, or you know, you'd put icing and fancy fondant.
It sounds like a rusk.
Yeah, it was very practical. Yeah. And there's a mention of it in Shropshire from at least around the 17th century.
Mm.
So there's some argument that it might have been a medieval tradition.
Okay,
but
that's interesting.
In Shropshire, we've got a written account from John Aubrey from the 17th century, and he said in Salop on All Souls Day there is a set upon a board of heaped soul cakes lying on each other like the picture of the sowbread in the old Bibles. They're about the bigness, great word, of 2D cakes, and nearly all visitants that day take one, and there is an old rhyme or saying said. But to me, Aubrey's account suggests that it is a long-standing tradition.
Yeah, it's implied, isn't it? It doesn't sound like new. Yeah.
But there's no idea exactly in Shropshire whether it is medieval or not. But sometimes in some areas, like in Oswestry, the Souling rhyme included some lines of Welsh, which I think kind of suggests and highlights the interplay between life on the border. If you live on the border, you are a product of both areas and neither. It's kind of a very liminal place to kind of live and exist. But John Aubrey states that the most common forms, so this is in the 17th century, of the rhyme is a soul cake, have mercy on all Christian souls for a soul cake.
God.
And then we've got Reverend E.A. Godson of Clive, saying that it was in his area, soul for an apple or two, got no apples, pears will do, up with the kettle and down with the pan, give me an apple and I'll be gone, one for Peter, two for Paul, three for him that makes us all, apple or pear, plum or cherry, anything good to make us merry, merry I am and merry I be, please give an apple away to me. There you go.
That's better.
Yeah.
He's put more of it.
A little bit of rhyming scheme. And then we've got our Queen Charlotte Byrne saying that she says that the original form in her mind was the one that came from Market Drayton.
Oh, okay. Time, yeah.
Yeah. And she says that that's the purest example. And it's soul for a soul cake. I pray good misses a soul cake. An apple or pear, a plum or cherry, any good thing to make us merry. One for Peter, two for Paul, three for him that made us all. Up with the kettle and down with the pan. Give us good alms and we'll be gone. So you've got similarities in all of these, and you've got that kind of religious, vaguely religious tradition. But every area in reality would have had a different kind of rhyme. They'd have had a different way of portraying it. I imagine if you'd been to a few houses and you'd had some, you know, ale given to you, you'd probably be a little bit more slurred.
I think you'd add a cock joke in that as well. You'd be like, do you know what I mean? Otherwise you'd just be like, oh, give me a fucking biscuit. Like,
yeah, come on.
Your plums and your pears and you're jumping down the stair, give me a fucking biscuit. But I think it's you know, at some point they must have added lyrics that were not quite as salubrious as I've got a pear and I'm up a tree and give one.
Oh, definitely.
Before they're like, sod Peter and Paul, just give me a bloody biscuit. But I mean, I think the first one showed the least effort, but
yeah,
they definitely got better by Charlotte kind of repeating when it became sort of characteristically quite articulate by them. But I think particularly the last two definitely shared a theme. But yeah, it's fascinating. I suppose, but it's, you know, like we said in, I think it was our first app, we talked about the devil's chair. And again, like some people will say he was on his way to Wales, some were like he's against people of Shrewsbury, others are like, you know, it always varies, doesn't it, according to sort of where you are, and the story is slightly different. And it's the same with any kind of old songs, like, you know, what's that one? It's a Victorian musical song. It's, you know, it's the same the whole world over, and it's the poor that get the blame. It's a really cool, you know, it's a lovely old musical song, but the lyrics are always slightly different. And again, it depends in which part of the country you're from. And the same with old songs like Oh My Darling Clementine. Again, like some verses are completely omitted in others, and others, it alters, doesn't it, according to the, some are quite colourful versions as well, that sort of not so subtly allude to, like, you know, sex or penises or something. But, you know, and I'm sure these biscuits are no exception to that.
Oh no, definitely. And I think one thing that's worth noting, I think I've mentioned it before, is that a lot of these Victorian folklorists only wrote down what they deemed acceptable.
So they definitely had much more kind of raunchy stuff, but these guys were like, this does not suit our sensibility.
Yeah, so there's a number of references in A Sheaf of Gleanings by Charlotte Byrne, where she says that, you know, so she's gone to some village and they've told her a cure for like gout or something like that, or, you know, some sort of like eczema or something, but she says that it's too disgusting for her to repeat. And you're like, oh no, come on, like, tell me the disgusting cure.
You and I'd be like, that's a nice cure. So what's the rude one?
Yeah.
I would love to go somewhere like that, like sit in someone's house going, that is interesting. And may I take down the details? And they're like, and then you take the foreskin of this. And you're like, oh my God. You're like, really? Is that going to help my cold? Yeah, almost certainly. Is it? Why? Just take the foreskin. Great. Yeah. And we're just writing that down in capitals. Okay, undermining foreskin there. And like, I just love the kind of some of those, like, no, don't put that in. I'm like, put it in. That would remind me of like any story that like my mom or my grandmother or something tell me, like, and they kind of always have to be quite polite. And I'm like, oh God, tell me the funny bit. Come on. Like, don't protect me. Okay. There's nothing to protect me from. I love the funny bits. Like, yeah. But then I will obsess over the funny bits and be like, what do you think they meant? And it's like, oh, for God. So yeah, maybe don't send me to someone's house to get rude remedies for things. I'd never leave.
No.
Maybe at the wedding, bloody hell, she's back.
She's back.
She's got a bag of severed cocks. What's that going to cure?
But I do. I think definitely these kind of rituals would have got rowdy. I think not so much when it's children. I think children have a certain level of, you know, oh, give us a soul cake, sir. I don't know why I'm a Cockney. I'm in trouble.
I love your voice just went up like... Give us a soul cake, sir.
Thanks, sir. Just one soul cake, please.
Dick Van Dyke.
I'm sorry to anyone that's from London for that. That was appalling on my behalf.
Don't feel threatened. I know. I love that. That's pretty. That was like uncharacteristically high pitched.
Yeah, but I think, you know, children. But I think when you get to kind of the adults, because that's the thing with souling as well. I think it's often linked to modern day kind of trick or treating, and it does have kind of parallels. But anyone could go souling. So there could be children, adults, grown men would go. And I think what's really interesting is the long,
isn't it, I think?
Yeah, the longevity of some of these traditions, particularly souling. So Charlotte Byrne says that it was going on till at least middle to late 1850s, 1860s.
Okay.
We've got Reverend E. Godson of Clive again saying that it was in 1909 they were still doing it. And interestingly, there's a reference to it having been around 1938, having just died out in Wem.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's grandparents' era, do you know what I mean? My grandparents were in 1940, so that's not far off. Like, that's, wow, okay. That's such very much in lifetime.
Yeah. Know? Yeah, and a lot of the kind of, it was seen as almost that for the women that were the ones doing the baking, the ones making the soul cakes, it was almost seen as kind of like a something to be proud of. So they would try and kind of one-up each other, or, you know, the more liberal housewives would dedicate whole days to baking, and then they would hand out the fruits of their labour, and there'd be whole baskets of cakes for the children and for anyone else who came. And there's several women that quite stubbornly clung on to it, even after the whole of the rest of the area had stopped providing the cake. So there's a woman who Charlotte Byrne references called Mrs. Mary Ward, who She was the last known woman in Pulverbatch to bake soul cakes.
And that's just and, up the road. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's cool.
And she died in 1853, but she was 100 years old.
Oh
and she
God.
Yeah, queen. Yeah. And she'd been doing it for all of her lifetime, for as long as she could. So it really was something that I think, as hard as life was for the people that were begging, it was also something that made people quite proud. The people that were able to provide the soul cakes, it was a sense of pride, and it was that sense of community. So I think just as much of it being a relic of a quite a difficult period of history and quite difficult lives, it also, I think, emphasizes the idea of a community.
Yeah. It's extraordinary, isn't it? And I think, and I mean, to be honest, like, that's still going on today. And I think, and I know you made some soul cakes, which I love. And I think that should be something that kind of comes back. But I think, look at people now going to pumpkin patches and things like that. You know, like, it's still a thing, isn't it? Where people are kind of doing communal, you know, and they're sharing photos and kind of being, you know, excited about this sort of communal thing that they're all doing to decorate their houses and things. And is it that different? You know, I mean, I know they're not going around begging, kind of handing out biscuits and stuff, but, you know, this kind of community or camaraderie around such an ancient festival is just so, so interesting. And this idea of kind of like even the dressing up, going to people's houses, you know, you've got this kind of, I don't know, sort of like a thread of like a Saturnalia feel to it as well, haven't you? Which is just so, so interesting. And then I suppose, I mean, is there anything else in terms of like things that they do that you kind of feel? Because I know one thing I did think was really interesting, and again, you'll know definitely the Shropshire reference and more about it than me, but was this idea of jack-o'-lanterns. So, you know, we know about pumpkins because in the 19th century, the Irish kind of took this idea of carving turnips. And I tried that, as you saw the photo of him, and he was really cute. But I mean,
he's adorable.
Like, that guy was hard to carve. Like, I was like, I'm so sorry, I'm hollering at your head. But like, he was tiny and he was really hard to carve. But like the pumpkins in America obviously were prolific. And so they were like, how about this? And the Irish were like, this works. I like this. Much, much easier. Sorry, turnips, you've had your day, which makes me sad, but they are coming back. So the turnips, cometh the hour, cometh the turnip. But, you know, but I think it's interesting because like the jack-o'-lanterns, I didn't realize until quite recently, is that kind of will-o'-the-wisp thing. You know, like that sort of like light that used to come off, was it the bogs and things like that? Is it peat bogs, things like that?
Yeah.
And that was kind of like an inspiration for this idea because people were lighting their way. And I thought, how is that like, but apparently so, that was the kind of the origins, particularly in Ireland, of this idea. And then jack-o'-lanterns and things followed suit, but they did used to use turnips to light their way as well, like as a kind of effective, albeit not that effective, like case for your candle. Like, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's vaguely linked to a similar idea in Shropshire. So we do have references to Will-o'-the-Wisps and kind of the idea. Yes. So
that is cool. Okay.
Particularly your neck of the woods and along the border. So you've got kind of the Welsh influence coming in.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Welsh. You've got the idea that they tend to, several references to them kind of being seen floating from house to house. And if they stop upon a house, that's a house that somebody will die in a kind of fixed amount of time. So either 7 days or 5 days or however many days, but they're seen as kind of like a death omen. But they are linked to a story that's not very well shared in Shropshire, but it is a Shropshire story, but it has kind of influence elsewhere. And that's the idea of Wicked Will the Blacksmith. And so then it's not directly Wicked Will the Blacksmith story isn't directly linked to kind of jack-o'-lanterns or turnips or that kind of thing, but elsewhere a very similar story has its origins in that practice. So the basic idea is Will the Blacksmith was a bloody good blacksmith.
Yeah, he's a bloody good blacksmith.
But yeah, he was an absolute rotter and he did everything that he could humanly do to be sinful.
I was gonna say, what, like, you don't need to be explained exactly, read between the lines, Alex.
Okay. He was a naughty boy, and when it came to his time to die, one of the angels, it depends, sometimes it's Michael, sometimes it's another angel, came to him and said that, you know, it's your time to die, you've been awful, you go into hell, basically. Mm. And I'm massively paraphrasing, but Will bursts out crying, he puts on a really good show, and he tells the angel if only he could have his life again, he would be better, he would be virtuous, he'd even go to church. So, you know, big stuff.
Yeah.
And the angel has pity on him and says, you know what, I'm going to give you another chance. We don't do this very often, but for you, I'm going to give you another chance. After all, you're a bloody good blacksmith. So
that's reason enough for me.
Yeah. So he lets him have another chance and tells him that when he goes to bed, he'll wake up the next morning as a baby and he'll have his time again. So
sounds like that to me. I'd be like, oh, come on. Like, can I go back to 20? Like,
what am I going to be a baby?
And also, like, if you wake up as a baby, is he going back as a baby with a man's mind? So he's cognitively thinking to myself,
I
have to be good for the rest of my life. Or is he just starting from scratch? In which case, massive risk that he could just be, end up being a massive bell end again.
Well, let's reveal. So when he wakes up.
Let me finish the story.
No. When he wakes up, he is a baby again.
Yeah.
And he lives his life again. And he's even worse than the first time round. So
spoiler. Yeah.
Absolutely awful. You know, he's just spends all of his time doing everything he can to wind up the angels. So when he dies again, he goes up to the pearly gates and the angels go, oh, you're having a laugh if you think you're coming in here. Like, go away.
No way, mate.
So they send him down to hell and the devil bursts out laughing. He says, you're having a laugh if you come in here. Like, I'm not having you in my gaff. You're awful. I like the idea of the devil using the word gaff.
Yeah, I do as well. I think he would. Yeah.
And he says, look, you know, I can't have you in hell because you're worse than me.
Jesus.
So he sends him back up to the angels and he says, look, at the end of the day, the only reason you're in this position is because the angels gave you another chance. I'm not having you in hell. Grow up, they can sort you out. Yeah. So he goes up again and he gets sent back to hell again.
Oh,
and the story culminates in the devil saying, look, I can't have you, but I will give you a coal from hell to keep you warm, and you are doomed to wander for eternity. Wicked Will the blacksmith becomes a will-o-wisp, and that piece of coal from hell is one of the things that changes him into the more spectral form. So it's very loosely linked, in Shropshire at least, to the idea of like kind of lighting and lanterns at Halloween. But elsewhere that I have seen similar stories that have that link. But it's a wonderful story, and I love the idea of this absolute rotter that was too bad for hell.
Just not learning his lesson. Guys, I just feel like as soon as they're like, all right, I'm taking pity. And you're like, you feel like the voice should come over and be like, spoiler, he was an even bigger prick by the end of the second time. Like, this guy, like, he is a walking red flag. You're like, yeah. And it's a great old story, but that guy is, you know, he's a rumman, basically.
Yeah,
absolutely. But, you know, he's one of those, you don't need the details of what he's done. You just get the vibe. You're like, I've got it. I get it. Like, I don't need to hear what he's done, because, I mean, I kind of do, but I'm also like, no, do you know what? I think if the devil is like, get out.
You know, he's been bad. A bad egg, hasn't he?
Yeah, because like, he's not great. As a general rule, he's not an okay guy. So shall we talk a little bit about ghosts and ghosts in literature?
Yeah, that would be amazing. Definitely. Yeah.
That would be great. You talked about Dickens. So like, I'm not going to go in chronological order with this, because I know that we kind of passed from the cock to the cat with this one as well. But in terms of ghosts in literature, of course, and we spoke on the last episode about Jacob Marley, and he is the kind of the definitive, and I think he's probably the go-to if you were to think of ghosts. And when you think of this idea of Scrooge in his, you know, in that very old house that they allude to, or not even allude to, that is explained in the book, that is from I can't remember the line, but he explains it being from a previous century. So we already know that Scrooge is in this creepy old house, and he's only occupying a couple of rooms in there. And it's the idea of this servant's bell starts to ring. And what I love about this is Dickens' kind of idea that that his description of a ghost story is so layered. So if you find something visual creepy, well, you see Jacob Marley. If you find hearing something creepy, you hear the chains in the winemaker's cellar. You know, like he's got a bit of a fright for everyone there. Like,
yeah.
It's so good because he's also kind of slightly tongue in cheek with it as well. So like it's moralistic. He's also slightly taking the piss because he does, you know, that line that you and I both love, with there's more gravy than a grave.
Yes.
So, and even when he talks about his chains, which he forged in life, you know, it's so sort of spooky and moralistic that it is really creepy, but it's also so over the top that you are able to kind of be slightly amused by it as well. But I think he just kind of, to me, epitomizes the classic ghost story. But I know I said to you earlier in the week that for me, when I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, okay, so who's a good ghost in literature? And then I thought, well, if I say this person, I sound like a prick because she's not actually a ghost, and it sounds like you're just trying too hard to be clever. But if I was thinking of someone that kind of represented something spooky and ghostly, it's got to be Miss Havisham, hasn't it? Because
yeah,
she is just fantastic. I think her wedding dress, which is like, you know, she hasn't kind of gone, look, what do you like, you know, do you like my outfit? Like, that is kind of a life choice, that dress.
Yeah.
But you know, she's maybe more of a phantom than a ghost, because she's alive, but it's this phantom grand repast, you know, that the mice are gnawing at, just as she explains that they're gnawing at her, you know. And at the end, the fact that this wedding dress that is so kind of central to her is her demise, because it catches in the fire and she dies of her injuries, you know. And it's this idea of her kind of demanding he plays for her, and so she's in the moment and she's present and with Estella, but then also she has this idea of all the clocks are stopped. Is it 9:40, 9:29, isn't it, I think? And she's in this house that time is absolutely frozen still because Meriwether Compson's a prick. I mean, also, like, it's complicated. I think she could have had a really good life, and you know, you're like, come on, Havisham, at some point, like, you know. But she's had a breakdown, so it's complicated. But I just think she is, to me, like, if you didn't believe in ghosts, she is the best example of a ghost. Because, you know, if you refuse to believe that a ghost can come back after death, then Havisham has to be like the closest you can get to believing in a ghost, because she is a ghost, the version of what she was. And you know, one of my favorite portrayals, actually, I always think, you know, Helena Bonham Carter, people like that, they do a great job, but they kind of make her a little bit too maniacal, and they don't get the essence of this woman that, as I imagine her, that had been beautiful, that is still very wealthy, that has something of an appeal about her, where Pip is scared of her but also is worried about her later in life, you know. So there must be something about this still a draw. And I think it's Tuppence Middleton in Dickensian, which does not adhere to the stories fully. It's a kind of a prequel. I hate that word, but you know, it's a kind of beginning. But I think if anyone hasn't seen it, they should, because I think, only because also Anton Lesser plays Fagin, he's amazing, but she plays Miss Havisham before she is Miss Havisham, if you see what I mean. So, you know, and her brothers in it as well, Arthur and Meriwether Compson, all this lot, and they kind of play loose and fast with it, but they sort of imagine what happened before she became Miss Havisham. But I think they do it in a very good way, in a very tasteful way. It's very kind of non over the top and things. It's all, because, you know, even the detail of her shoe, which of course we all know because she, you know, rubs her foot and things. So at the end of the scene of Dickensian, and she's sitting there holding a shoe, and you can see this big repast in front of her, and she's just sitting there, and kind of they're singing Marble Halls in the background. Like, it's really creepy. It's really creepy. And I think that for me is if you were going to say who was a ghost that wasn't a ghost, she is the pinnacle of that for me in satisfied, to be satisfied, to have enough. Like, her life, yeah, she is fascinating. Who's your favourite literary ghost?
Oh, that's a tough one, because I spend most of my life reading history books. But I think
so you're not into
But I think Kathy from Wuthering Heights.
Oh, that's such a good one. That I think such a good one.
I think it's so visceral.
Good, yeah.
And that's I think in a way, the idea of, and I think it links to Havisham, the idea that someone can be haunted by their past.
Well, he's just really acting powerful. Like Miss Havisham, isn't he, really? I mean, I know he goes on and gets married and things, and he has, is it Brereton's his son or his brother-in-law? I can't remember, I get their names wrong. But yeah, sorry, carry on.
So I think it's just that, it's that idea of, she is a very visceral ghost. The idea of like tapping on the window and scratching and saying, let me in, and all that kind of, I lost my way on the moor or whatever it is. That is really powerful.
Lost my way on the moor, whatever.
Yeah.
Let me in, Fox. Like, yeah.
Been a while since I read it, but I think that is a real standalone one for me. But I think when you look at Heathcliff, and it very much links to what you've just been saying, is that it's almost more scary for someone to be haunted by a version of their past or a version of an imagined version of their future, because both of these characters have seen something in their future that isn't there, that didn't come to be, but then they can't move away from that. And I think that is really quite frightening as a human being, because I think we all invest ourselves in different things, in jobs, you know, relationships, whatever, and the idea that all that investment could come to nothing, how would you respond to that after that?
That's so interesting. That's such an interesting way of looking at it. And ultimately that has to be the kind of the pinnacle of a ghost story as well, doesn't it? And I think it's Hareton as well, not Britton. So there you go.
Yes,
that was annoying. Yeah. I was thinking, oh, is it Hareton? Yeah. And it's, that's such an interesting point. And it's the same when you think, you know, you look at things like, you know, like in Macbeth and Banquo, however you say his name, when, you know, when he appears, only Macbeth can see him at the feast, and he's all blood-stained and things like that. And, you know, you've got the princes in the tower appearing to, you know, Edward and Richard appearing to him in his, you know, before the Battle of Bosworth and things. It's so creepy. And also when he sees the ghost of Henry VI, you know, all these, there's quite a few ghosts in that play, I know, but in Richard III, but equally, like throughout, when he kind of, you know, you have the ghost of Julius Caesar, and Shakespeare, he loves to bring in a ghost. And I think Hamlet's father as well, like that's really creepy. But I think for me, Macbeth, like that is the one when he appears and he's all kind of covered in blood, and he's like, that is terrifying. It's so kind of visceral and clear, and I just think it's really, really creepy. And I think another one for me, and again, I mentioned it in a previous episode, was The Turn of the Screw, when you have Miss Jessel and Peter Quinn, because like those two, Peter Quinn scares the shit out of me. And like, he was an absolute arsehole in real life. And then he's kind of there like tapping at the window, being a complete twat in death as well. And you're like, take a day off. You're like, he's the ultimate fuckboy. But like, he doesn't just slide into your DMs or anything like that. And when you block him, like he slides into the fucking afterlife and then slides into your reality, like making a governess basically eventually lose the plot and then commit infanticide because she's holding this child to protect him from the ghost. And spoiler, he gets smothered. But, you know, then there's, of course, the debate, you know, in the Henry James is whether she is, in fact, seeing ghosts, or because the children never fully, I know at the end, Miles says he does, but is he going along with her? Like, you know, is she imagining it because of the isolation being at Bligh, or I don't know. It's fascinating. But like Peter Quinn, you know, this idea that even Miss Jessel, who kind of falls under his spell, and he just kind of sort of proceeds to be this absolute arse that like in death as well holds such a hold over these women, that because, you know, in true kind of its style seem a little bit hysterical, and so much so that in protecting a child she literally smothers him. So, you know, the messages are pretty apparent, but I think they are really, really fascinating. And I think, like you said, Cathy Earnshaw, which I think is really interesting because, you know, of course, in Wuthering Heights and Kate Bush gives us the song, which then kind of makes us so familiar yet again with their names. But that image, you know, is so ingrained in our rhetoric, you know. So if you go anywhere, you know, I mean, God, I'm pretentious enough to always be kind of captioning photographs saying very Wuthering Heights-esque, or like if I go on a run and get to the top of the Stylish Danes, I like dub it with like the Wuthering Heights song. You know, I'm a prick. But like, it's, you know, it's so in our minds that people kind of go, oh, it's very Wuthering Heights-esque. And, you know, I'm always finding it interesting actually that is often described as one of the great love stories, a bit like Jane Eyre, and you're like, well, is it? Is it like Jane Eyre, he kind of dupes the governess while his sort of his wife, who is very unwell, is locked in a tower with only a nurse. I say nurse, but like her lady, you know, her servant to help her, who probably is grossly underqualified for looking after someone like that. You know, he then later burns down the house because she sees Jane in her wedding dress, which, you know, would be a bit of a blow to anyone, let alone, you know, if you know, in, given everything that Bertha Mason's going through. But I do think it's really interesting how these ideas that we will see romance in everything, like we were saying earlier about, you know, looking at the people that were poor in society and going, oh, isn't that romantic? They're Morris dancing or they're begging. So, you know, it's so enchanting. And you're like, is it, or are these issues that we should address? And it's the same thing with things like Jane Eyre or like, you know, Cathy and Heathcliff and things. And Heathcliff, he is mistreated, which I feel very sad about, but also a bit of a brute as an adult. Like, he's really not great to his young wife and he kicks the shit out of people, you know, like it's quite problematic. And Cathy kind of haunts him, literally punches a hole in the window and puts her hand through, you know, as a ghost. You're like, this is a lot. Like, yeah. I'm thinking at some point you gotta let someone move on.
Yeah.
It seems there like it's this great debate of, is the ghost the person holding the back, or is this person clinging to the ghost, you know, that may never actually exist? Is it just their imagining? And I think, you know, I kind of completely overlooked that actually Jane Eyre is almost like a ghost as well, because that wife, Bertha, in the house, who's kind of so represented as this kind of like hindrance, when actually it's deeply sad what's happened to her. Yeah. And she has no control over what's happened to her, and she mentally, you know, but because it's written in its time, she kind of is sort of billed as a bit of a pain, and you're like, well, you know, she's not well, is she? And you know, you look at Rebecca and Mrs. Danvers being completely mad and ending it in a very kind of Jane Eyre way as well, saying fire to the house and these kind of lines that you and I are not designed to be happy, or whatever the quote was. You know, it's fascinating that sometimes with a ghost, they don't always need to be dead, do they, to be
no.
bloody terrifying and haunting your life. They could just be Mrs. Danvers. I love it. I love a ghost story. I love, you know, The Woman in Black. I love a jump scare and things like that. But I do think there are certain characters in literature that just, if you were going to look at ghosts and things, just absolutely resonate. And for me, Havisham, she's the one, without a doubt. And heartbreak is that great leveler, isn't it? Like, so from Wuthering Heights, whatever it may be, you know, rich or poor, most of us experience heartbreak. And I think it's the response to it. And it's this idea, of course, that, you know, when we hear about it now, we find it kind of almost like enchanting and we sort of feel sad and relating to a story of somebody that may or may not have existed, may or may not have been based. I mean, I say may or may not. We know that Havisham didn't, but who was she based on? There's so many different stories, you know, because her story to a degree resonates, you know, somebody heartbroken, but this idea of haunting her house, walking around in a wedding dress, all these gothic imagery that we kind of find bizarre and we look at in almost like a Victorian freak show, but we also, something of our heart kind of goes to her a bit. And you, I think, increasingly. And also because, you know, she was let down by a man, and spoiler, that happens.
Yeah.
And the comparison is awful. So yeah, sorry, you go.
I think it's interesting because we've kind of naturally moved on to an aspect of kind of All Saints, All Souls, that Hallow Mass kind of tradition that's the flip side of some of this. So believe it or not, it's not the most romantic of times in theory, but apparently All Saints and All Souls, All Saints and All Souls Eve, it's a bit of a tongue twister, was one of the best times to be able to actually practice love divination.
Really?
Yeah, so you could practice love divination all year round, but it was seen to be a particularly potent time where young women or men could hear beyond the veil, that idea of the veil again and the ancestors being able to act within your life and witness your future spouse, or if you were very unlucky, a coffin, which meant you were going to die alone.
Can you imagine? You'd be like, oh, I'm looking, what is it, what does he look like, is he tall, has he got dark hair, he's dishy, oh no, it's a coffin, oh,
yeah, I'm sorry. Dead.
Oh shit, like worst like lucky dip ever. You're like, oh yeah, picked up near death. Oh well, that'll be me. That's great story of my life.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you'd think with something like love divination, you'd have to have like a sacred circle of salt and all this kind of wishy-washy thing that I think 90s TV put forward for the idea of magic.
Fully.
But in reality, even the most mundane of objects could give you a insight into who your spouse was going to be. So one of the weirdest I've come across is that a woman who was eager to find a husband must go to the local churchyard at midnight on All Saints or All Souls Day. You could do either.
This sounds like a really weird, like, you know, the guy just goes, do you know what? You're going to find out who marries you, because just go here at midnight on this day. You'd be like, do you mind if I don't? Because I don't want to get attacked. But
it gets slightly weirder.
Oh, so God.
You're meant to stagger around in the dark in the churchyard looking for half a brick. It cannot be a full brick. It has to be half a brick.
Look, if someone's left half a brick there, sorry, look, tell this story, but this is fucked up. Yeah, go on.
No. And then once you found that half a brick, you take it back home, you put it under your pillow, and you will dream of your future marriage.
Oh, is he going to turn up with the other half of the brick?
I'd like that. That would be a good twist.
I would, but I mean, if it is, this guy's a bigamist, because if he's going around like churchyards going, just pick up half a brick and the love of your life will turn up with the other half of the brick. Like, oh, okay. I mean, I love it. I think I shouldn't take the piss, because actually as a story, it's fantastic, but it's so like, I don't know. Is it quite male? I don't know. I don't know if it is a bit patriarchal. Maybe not. Maybe it's kind of, it feels
weird.
Like that typically, the wonderful thing, and I know you and I both love this about folklore, is that it doesn't always matter whether people believe it's true or not. But I love that sometimes it's almost like they say things tongue in cheek, like the more fucking random, the better. Do you know what I mean? Like, go to the churchyard. Like, do you know what? Stumble around in the dark, get a brick butt, and then you feel like someone's going, spoiler, half a brick. You're like, half a brick.
Yeah.
Kind of going on the upside. You're like, if she's doing all this, she probably deserves a dream of her love, because not many people have got the balls to go to a churchyard in the dark, stumble around, and then find me in half a brick. I'd be like, I'd go from one side to the other, like as a dare, and be like, and that's me. I'm done. Like, I am not fumbling around for a brick in a churchyard, like on Crazy Eve or something. I'd be like, do you mind if I just, like, can I do it at midday? Is that okay? Does it have to be dark? You go.
I do think with some of these things, there is that idea, like you said, of the weirder the better. And someone has asked them, right, so someone like Charlotte Byrne, what's your ideas on love divination round here? And they've gone, right, how can we wind this woman up?
Yes, that's what I'm hoping. I'm wondering if they're going, do you know what, just tell her this because she'll repeat it.
Yeah.
You're like, it's so random that you kind of think they have to have been, they obviously stem from somewhere as well, but equally, I love that the mischief that's in them. I love that humor, and that kind of makes it even more endearing that, you know, a lot of the time they're probably slightly taking the piss out of the church. They're slightly taking the piss out of other people, you know? So it's this kind of idea that people patronize them in this bucolic, very sweet way of life. Aren't they sweet? Aren't they sweet?
Yeah.
And they're just kind of like also slightly taking the piss, because they're like, yeah, fuck it. Like, do you want half a brick? Make it half a brick. Like, whatever's going to work for you. Like, that's fine. And I know lots of things that they did believe in. But again, like, it was the same as that French writer when he said that he talked about horseshoes and things like that. And he said that it was met with people telling him with humor, but also part of them still believed it. And I think we're not that different today. We kind of like laugh about stuff, but we also salute magpies. Like, we're, you know, like, I think I've said that before, but, you know, we don't generally walk under ladders, probably for common sense, but, you know, it's still interesting that these ideas, we kind of like joke about them just as they would have at the time. But do you know what? If part of you thought, you know, if you were single or whatever, and part of you thought, you know, if you put that under your pillow, you'll see who your husband's going to be, you'd be amazed how many people would do that.
Like,
you know, would go, fuck it. Who's going to know if I do that? You know,
no one will know.
Go for it. Like, you know, I think it's, that's what I find so interesting. And I think, like, we, you know, to say, as I said, that a heartbreak was the great leveler, I also think that actually in a lot of ways, folklore, history, all these things are, because all you realise is that things change a bit, and maybe our aptitude for cruelty, things like this, and hopefully we've improved in that way, that they're not where we should be. But we don't change that much. We still laugh at willies and bums, and you know, we still laugh at, like, you know, whatever. We're still scared of ghosts. We still love to pull someone's leg and things like that. And I think it's just so, it's fantastic. It's fascinating. And I think that maybe these festivals, that maybe some were formed in some ways by the church and other aspects of it predate religion as we would think of it, or more maybe pagan, will probably last longer still, because that human proclivity for mischief, fun, for fear and things like that will never tire. I think it'll always remain. Hopefully as well, because it'll mean people listen to our podcast. Everyone suddenly turn their back on the macabre and gothic and stuff. We'll be like, oh, yeah. Bloody hell, what are we going to talk about now? but I think it's fabulous. Have you got anything that you want to add to our Halloween special?
So I want to just briefly mention a story, a folk story from Cherbury Church.
Oh, yeah, please do, because I love a story. Go on.
And Cherbury Church, which is a bit of a tongue twister, Cherbury Church.
It is, isn't it? Cherbury Church.
Yes. It finds itself in the centre of a slightly different type of divination.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea that if you go there and you enact a certain ritual, you will find out who in the parish will die.
Oh my God.
So, bit dark. And it said that if you visit the church on All Saints' Eve, you will gain that direct knowledge. The ritual itself involves walking or running, if you choose, to around the building anti-clockwise 12 times.
Bloody hell.
You have to do this slightly before midnight and then wait until the bells chime for midnight. And then if you sit on the church steps, you'll be rewarded with a roll call. So it's kind of like some accounts say that it's kind of a visual thing, but others say that you would hear the names. So I think it depends on who's telling the story. But yeah. With that being said, you'll find out everyone in the locality who'll die before the following All Saints Eve. So
God.
We're told in folklore that in 1788, two young men decided to try out the custom. So they had been in their local alehouse, and they had probably been partaking in a little bit of the libations, more than a few libations. And they thought it was a very good idea to go to Cherbury Churchyard and try and acquire this forbidden knowledge. So they go, they probably less walk and more stumble around 12 times and wait. Now, the idea is quite clever in a way. They were going to find out who was on the list, take out debts with them all, and then because they die within the year, they'd never have to pay them back the money.
Bloody hell.
So it's in their drunken stupor, that was like big brain time. They were really pleased with that thinking. So while they were waiting, they were kind of giggling and quite amused with themselves. And when the clock struck midnight, they heard this raspy, drawn-out voice read out the list of names. And it went on for quite some time. It was a busy year for death that year. But quite suddenly, they heard a name that made their blood run cold and their heart pound in the chest. Because one of the names that was read was the one man's brother and the best friend of the other. And as soon as they heard his name, they didn't stop to hear the rest of them. They ran from the churchyard and began banging quite firmly on his door. And after three loud knocks, now I love this because the knocks of death in Shropshire folklore are three knocks on the door of a nighttime. And after three knocks, the drunken man kind of still kept banging. And the man who wasn't drunk, the man who'd been very soundly asleep prior to that, opened his door. And the drunken men explained everything. They said that they'd been messing around in the churchyard and they heard that he was going to die.
Yeah.
And he told them in no uncertain terms that he wasn't planning to die and told them to basically bugger off away from his house and told them to go and sober up.
As you probably would, to be honest.
You would, wouldn't you?
If banging on your door, you'd be like, oh, come on.
You know, if you turned up at my house of the night time saying, oh, I've just heard you're going to die, I'd be like, leave me alone, go to bed.
You'd be like, look, it's not episode 4 yet, all right? Just say that's next week.
Go to bed, Alex. But
stop the research. Let it go.
But rather interestingly, we're told in this folk tale that a week later, the man who had had the knocks on the door was dead.
Oh, so my God.
The prophecy had been fulfilled. And those men who had been, you know, drunk in the churchyard never visited the church again. And they also never spoke of their experiences again. Why we have the folk story, I don't know. But supposedly they never spoke of it again. I love this because not only does it link All Saints and All Souls Day to a form of divination, because you've got love divination, you've got other forms of kind of love divination as well, as the one I mentioned, but also the idea that, going back to that idea of the veil again, the veil is so thin that you can actually peel it back and see who is going to join. And also that this kind of power isn't something that we should have. We should treat it with responsibility, and that actually when we don't do it responsibly and we do kind of mess around like those lads were doing, there's going to be consequences. And I think it's just a really, it's a hilarious story. And you can imagine, you know, as the nights were drawing dark, someone in the local pub or in their home telling it with, you know, acting it out and putting all of the kind of slurring their words and things. But also it's quite a powerful message that we don't mess around with these kind of things, and that in kind of situations of life and death, we need to respect the dead and respect the ideas around death. So I think it's wonderful. And Cherbury Church as well, if you ever are looking for a, if you're like myself and Alex and like historical churches, it's a wonderful historical place, very beautiful church with really quite interesting interior. I've never run round it of a night time though. I've got to say, I've never done it.
And then rocked up and gone, Alex, you're going to die.
Yes, sorry about that, Bab. But
you'd be like, let's get two more episodes in before you do. We'll just block record those. And yeah, then you do what you need to do. But I think it's, it's funny. It's, and the Victorians are kind of great examples of anybody that's going to sort of, you know, if you're trying to dance with that kind of thing, you're invariably going to kind of get your foot trodden on, aren't you? Because, you know, we love this idea that, you know, you think, oh, if you do this and if you do that, and you know, like the old school favorite where you kind of look in the mirror and say Bloody Mary, and then a hand's going to strangle you, and you're like, for God's sake. But I tell you, that has scared the shit out of many a school child, myself included. But you know, this idea that actually, no matter how silly you might think it is, part of you goes, oof, is it true? You know, because there are stories that you hear and something happens, or, you know, maybe there's a kind of prophecy of death, and maybe that person dies within a couple of years or something. That, look, could it be coincidence? Quite possibly, maybe absolutely, but it still leaves you with a little bit of a fear and a little bit of something spooky. And I thought maybe the thing to end on, if you wanted to think of something spooky, was probably one of like the eerier lines I always think, which is from The Turn of the Screw, which is, if a child gives the effect another turn of the screw, what do you say to two children? Because they, nothing spookier than like creepy kids, is there really?
No.
The turn of the screw, double trouble. I love it. I love it. So that's our Halloween. I love it. Gothic, scary, creepy. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Amy. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Very much so. And thank you, Alex. Loved it.
Thank you. Right. See you all soon. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.